From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor, and Philippe Gelly, U.S. chief correspondent for Le Figaro. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard, Michael Warren.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin met in Helsinki on Monday to talk about issues confronting the two countries. But Trump's refusal to confront Putin publicly about Russia's interference in the 2016 election drew criticism from many, even within his own party. The Trump-Putin meeting took place against the backdrop of the U.S. Justice Department indicting 12 Russian intelligence agents last week for interfering in that election. An additional Russian national living in the United States was arrested and indicted this week on charges she was also trying to influence American politics. British Prime Minister Theresa May, facing a possible revolt within her own Conservative Party, presented her plan for Britain's exit from the European Union. And finally, the Israeli government passed a new law declaring the country the nation-state of the Jewish people. The law is causing controversy in Israel, earning condemnation from both the opposition coalition as well as Arabs in the country. Well, I think the big story of the week is Trump and Putin and Russia. And I think we really have to start, gentlemen, with what happened last week, at the end of last week, with this indictment of 12 Russian military intelligence agents. Michael, bring us up to speed about what exactly happened and how it set the stage for Helsinki.
Yeah, what happened was there was an indictment brought by Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller accusing 12 Russian intelligence agents of meddling, essentially, in U.S. elections. It really details the size and the scope of this entire operation. We really get a clear picture from this indictment, if you read it, about what exactly happened and when it exactly started. Some of the most interesting, if you will, information comes from when certain dates coincide. For instance, you talk about a date when the then-candidate President Trump calls for Russia to find the 30,000 emails from the Hillary Clinton server, and the indictment specifies that on that date there was an attempt at the DNC server, which is not the same server. I think it's important to note, but there seems to be some sort of nominal connection between those two. It really was a stunning amount of information about this operation, and clearly states definitively that this did happen. There is no way that people can say this wasn't an occurrence and that it didn't happen by officials within the Russian government.
Right, and it seemed, Philippe, that this indictment was really directed at the Russian government to say, this is what the United States government knows you did, that you were behind this, that this wasn't sort of independent state actors or independent actors doing this. We learned that some of these hackers who hacked the Democratic National Committee were not, in fact, sort of independent hackers, but were a part of the Russian government. This was really something from the Mueller investigation and from the Department of Justice directed right at Vladimir Putin right before this big summit right on Monday.
Yeah, you would assume that after such a counterintelligence report, which is, as Michael said, very detailed and very precise, there would be no more question about who did what during the 2016 election.
But
that's exactly what happened on Monday in Helsinki, when President Trump started a series of unbelievable series of blunders and steps that had to be corrected. And I mean, it lasted the whole week.
Oh, this occurred after their meeting during a public press conference where
right.
both Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin took a few questions from
right.
their respective
The first
journalists.
Is when Donald Trump says that he doesn't see why it would be Russia meddling into the election. Then there was this correction on the next day back in Washington that he wanted to say it wouldn't be Russia, which is probably one of the least credible excuse you can find. And I think it's on purpose. I mean, it's for his supporters. He was reading with a certain tone. He was reading a statement that was prepared by his staff. I mean, when he corrected the statement. And there were a few words to show his supporters that he didn't buy it. He was obliged to say it.
Right. And in Helsinki, Michael, the President Trump noted, in fact, what his intelligence agents, including his director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, who he appointed, said that Russia did interfere. Then he brought up the Vladimir Putin denial of that interference. And that is where, as Philippe said, where President Trump said he saw no reason why Russia would interfere. This was a real sort of throwing aside his own intelligence agents. That seems to be why he felt he had to clean it up. There was a real sort of outcry after that admission in Helsinki. Where does that stand now? Has the president sort of definitively said it was Vladimir Putin and it was the Russians? Is he equivocating a little bit still?
You used the right word just there. And this is where I was going to start, is equivocation. And I think this is where the outrage, if it exists, if you choose outrage or anything in that sort of range of emotion to respond to this, that's where the word starts. To equivocate the U.S. intelligence apparatus with Vladimir Putin on a stage, standing beside him, is mind-boggling to almost anyone who's seen any amount of foreign diplomacy. It is mind-boggling to think that the U.S. president would do that. It's mind-boggling to think that Dan Coats and his opinion and his work would be equivocated with Vladimir Putin and his work. To think, again, you'd have to say that Vladimir Putin, what he is claiming is that this happened. And Putin hasn't even exactly denied that this has happened himself. Right. He's just saying, I didn't know about it.
Right.
And to think that this type of operation would happen within Russia and that Vladimir Putin would not only not know about it, but wouldn't be personally directing it is absurd. Where is the president now as far as this? As soon as he makes a claim that, yes, I do believe in what our intelligence community has found out, he immediately equivocates and says, well, it was them. But a lot of people, could have been a lot of people.
Which is something he's consistently said really since the election, that it could be the famous 400-pound man in a basement somewhere.
Yes, and we learned from the New York Times last week that he was in fact briefed in detail in January 2017, right before taking office. So he's been denying what has been demonstrated to him by his intelligence services for 2 years now.
Right. Almost. But I just think we're glossing over really, and to roll it back and not to get out of order here, but what happened in that meeting? I mean, the president of the United States met with the Russian president in a room with only translators for 2.5 hours.
Well, this is what I wanted to bring up. I mean, besides the Russian meddling question, which really is not disputed by anybody but the president himself, really,
at this point
in the United States government, there are a host of issues that confront the United States and Russia. We're talking about Syria. We're talking about Eastern Europe. All sorts of realms in which these two countries and these two leaders have interests that conflict or may not always mesh. Do we have any sense of any movement on any of those issues? Let's just try to find one. Maybe Syria, maybe terrorism. Philippe, do we know about anything that they discussed in this meeting?
Well, we know we get it from the Russian side.
Right.
We have nothing from the White House that is tangible. The Russians have said that there were a host of oral agreements, verbal agreements, without specifying really, maybe about Syria. About this, the president mentioned something about the security of Israel without specifying.
Right.
What is very worrying is what has just been reported by Bloomberg about Ukraine. That was one of the worries. I can tell you, I had this conversation with European diplomats before the Trump-Putin meeting, and they were worried because Putin had been trying for months to sell to the Europeans a kind of referendum in eastern Ukraine, you know, and also with the UN intervention, a kind of peace operation there, to freeze the situation in Donbas and to get the annexation of Crimea recognized. And it seems that he presented this idea to President Trump and that it was not rejected out of hand.
And of course, as you point out, we really only know what the Russian view of these things are and the Russians'
but
own perspective.
On Ukraine, this is something apparently that President Putin himself told to his diplomats, his Russian diplomats, and that there was a leak even there.
Right. And before we move on from what happened in Helsinki, immediately after that press conference and after that one-on-one meeting between the two leaders, we found out actually about another indictment, an arrest and an indictment by the Department of Justice of a young woman, I believe she's 29, a Russian national named Maria Butina, who the Department of Justice claims was in the United States essentially as a part of a conspiracy to interfere in American politics. She had infiltrated some sort of conservative groups, mostly gun rights groups like the National Rifle Association. Michael, what happened with Maria Butina? Was there anything behind the release of this indictment so soon after the meeting between Trump and Putin?
Well, it's interesting that you say the timing, you know, because it seems as though big moments when there are opportunities for the justice and the intelligence community to say, hey, this is not a witch hunt.
Right.
They immediately produce a witch. And in this case, it's Maria Butina. Yeah, I do think that there's some timing and there's some coordination in terms of trying to push back against the president and his notion that none of this was happening. And we have somebody here who, and again, this is not espionage she's specifically accused of. She's been indicted on lobbying, essentially, without a permit. But when you look at the details, again, of the indictment, the circles that she's traveling in and the period of time that she's doing in very clearly show a long-term effort to create back channels between the GOP establishment and high-level officials in Russia who have direct connections to the government at the highest levels, including Putin. So is she the smoking gun, if you will? Pun intended. No, I think that she is not. But I think that, again, it shows just one more breadcrumb leading to the conclusion that, yes, there are nefarious forces at work here in our electoral system and something needs to be done.
Well, this is a story that's going to continue. We're going to have to take a quick break and we'll be back with more Issues in the News.
You're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America from Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor, and Philippe Gelly, U.S. chief correspondent for Le Figaro. Our moderator is Michael Warren, White House correspondent for The Weekly Standard.
All right, Philippe, let's talk about Brexit, the British exit from the European Union. Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, has a plan now? Has a possibility of a deal arrived? And what's the status of Brexit?
Well, that's hard to follow as well. Apparently, Theresa May's plan is very much contested in her own government. She has lost two or three ministers already.
Including the foreign minister,
exactly.
Boris Johnson.
And we are close to a coup, I mean, a political one at least, because she's accused of being too soft. And we have to notice that she hasn't been helped in this matter by President Trump, who, threatened last week there wouldn't be a trade deal with the UK if there was a soft Brexit. But the soft Brexit is almost necessary for England. I mean, the European market still is the biggest market for anything that the UK produces. So you cannot just cut it like that. And there was a report at the end of the week from the EU of what would happen in case of no deal. Brexit. That means no transition period. That would mean that at the end of March 2019, there would be an abrupt cut of links and relations between the UK and the EU, whereas a soft Brexit would open a transition period until the end of 2020. And that makes a huge difference for companies, for businesses, for borders, and so on and so forth. And one of the big issues right now is the Irish border, right. The border with Northern Ireland, where the EU wants a backstop agreement, a kind of, a hard border there, which Theresa May cannot accept. So this is one of the contentious points.
Michael, the before Helsinki, the president was in the United Kingdom, gave that interview to a British newspaper, essentially blasting Theresa May for the soft Brexit that Philippe was just discussing. And then President Trump sort of backed off that criticism, at least publicly, in front of Prime Minister May. The role of the United States and President Trump's trade policies in this attempt to fulfill what the British people voted on, the Brexit resolution. What is this really causing problems for Theresa May, and how could the President Trump's better relationship with someone like Boris Johnson, some of these people who have resigned in protest of Theresa May, how could that change things as we move forward?
Well, Theresa May didn't need any help from Donald Trump to be in trouble. she was in trouble anyway. And again, it's about, as Philippe suggests, it's about this definition between hard and soft and the ability to actually achieve that type of agreement. Look, the European Union, if they were going to give, why should they give the UK a great exit plan? Then why wouldn't everyone do that? If you get to keep all of the agreements with none of the commitments, why would you even have an EU? Then everybody could do it. So they're just not going to do that. I think in that sense, Boris Johnson has a point that they're probably not going to give them the deal that they would most like to have. It's going to be a tough deal. It's really going to be a tough deal. So it's not a, I think, a question of whether you're going to get hard or soft. You need to have soft. You're probably going to get something that's closer to hard. Boris Johnson and Donald Trump have been of the same mind since the last electoral process that brought Donald Trump into office. And I think, yes, Donald Trump would certainly like to see Boris Johnson in office. He sent a torpedo in Theresa May's direction. It didn't hit. And then he sort of apologized and said, well, I didn't mean to hit the firing button.
Could we be seeing in the UK a tougher conservative, a tougher pro-Brexit government coming into power here if Theresa May is deposed by her own members? And also, Philippe, what's the role here of Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, in any sort of deal-making?
Well, I think anything can happen in the UK. You can have a tougher government, but you, at the same time, it seems that the public opinion is having, in large part, I think, second thoughts about the bright future that the Brexit will offer them. Angela Merkel, I think, is on the line that Michael just explained, that if the EU is too generous with the UK, then it weakens itself. So if you can be outside of the EU and keep all the benefits of the EU, especially the economic benefits of the EU, then the temptation would be for others to get rid of all the constraint in terms of democracy, rule of law, justice. I mean, there are a lot of chapters when you join the EU. There are, I mean, it's thousands and tens of thousands of pages of regulation that you have to abide to. I mean, so what is at stake here, I think, is the future of the EU. Angela Merkel has that in mind. The downside of it, I think, is that she is so weak internally,
right,
that she cannot muster the political support that would be necessary to renovate,
right,
the EU, which is in need of a renovation, which the French President Emmanuel Macron has tried to do. But so far, this is all stalled.
Well, let's turn our attention to another world leader who seems embattled, and that's Benjamin Netanyahu. This decision for the Israeli government to pass a law sort of essentially declaring Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people. What is this law about? What's its purpose? And what does it mean internationally as well? Philippe?
Well, it's a huge piece of news. I mean, if there was not all the rest, this would be something big. I mean, this is the only democracy in the Middle East. And they pass a law, which is a basic law, So it will join a dozen of other basic laws that basically make the constitution of the country. And it says, and I quote, that the right of national self-determination is unique to the Jewish people. This contradicts the Declaration of Independence of Israel in 1948, which said that there was complete equality of social and political rights. So this is negated now. The second point is that Hebrew becomes the official language of the country, and Arabic, which is spoken by the minority of roughly 20% of citizens of Israel, is only a language with a special status, which is unspecified. And thirdly, it promotes the development of Jewish settlements as a national value. The earlier version of the law was to create exclusively Jewish localities. And they ended up with this new formulation, which is only slightly less damaging, because when you know the situation in the country, and in spite of the perfect legal, if you want, formal democracy, there were second-rate citizens, and there are second-rate citizens in Israel. And I've lived there for a number of years, and I have reported on that a lot. What happens now is that Jewishness is put above democracy in Israel. And it's not; it is not a small thing.
And there seems to be some domestic dispute. Obviously, the opposition party, centrist, and more the left-leaning parties.
Even the centrist parties say it's a racist law.
Right.
But it's all about internal politics. It's about Benjamin Netanyahu dealing with radical Orthodox religious parties in his coalition. I mean, American Jews are very angry with this,
right.
It's a kind of, it's a spiral, I think, on the right, on the part of Israel, and it goes with a lot of very weird things, like the closeness of Benjamin Netanyahu with Viktor Orban.
Right.
Hungary, where
the Hungarian leader, right?
600,000 of their 800,000 Jews during the war were killed.
Right.
I mean, this is very strange.
Well, what does this have to do, Michael, with Netanyahu's own? He's got a corruption probe into him. He's really sort of under fire, really not for political purposes, but for these corruption issues. Is this a sort of last ditch effort to kind of galvanize support for him and his coalition?
Yeah, I think it's an ongoing tool that's been used by many successful leaders across the globe. And I'm not going to call Bibi Netanyahu authoritarian just yet, but he certainly is a nationalist style of leader. And this is a tactic, this fervent nationalism, to say that anything that I do is secondary to my desire to protect you and your identity. So I think certainly it's a well-calculated move on his part internally. I think externally it weakens Israel. I can't say immeasurably, but we'll have to see just how far this will go in terms of just...
It's kind of a trend, I think, of illiberal democracies in Europe, elsewhere.
Well, as you say, it's the only democracy in the Middle East. This has been the linchpin, and rather than spreading democracy, it's contracting, it seems.
And this friendship with Viktor Orban is sort of underscores exactly what you're discussing, what we're seeing in other countries in Europe, this illiberal move from democratic countries.
And as
you
mentioned, his problems with the judiciary are part of this, because he's undermining the police, he's undermining the judicial system. I mean, this is all part of this illiberal trend in democracies.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Obviously, these issues will continue to be discussed as we go on. Thanks to Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor, and Philippe Jelly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Warren, White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.